Welcome to Blunt Dissection, the original and longest-running long-form interview show in veterinary medicine, where we delve into the minds of the creme de la creme of our profession and beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Dave Nicol. On each episode, I have the privilege of dissecting the success stories of world-class talent, those who have scaled the heights of achievement and are shaping the future of our field. Together, we'll explore their stories, their life-changing decisions, thought patterns, processes, habits, anything that enable them to operate at the very top of their game. Our goal? To give you the insights, the inspiration, the aha moments that you can use to carve your own pathway to success in this incredible field we call veterinary medicine. Because remember, everyone, you included, has a story. So sit back, take notes if you wish, and let's get ready to dissect success on another episode of the Blunt Dissection Podcast. So welcome to another episode of Blunt Dissection Podcast. I am really excited to have with me a guest that is a huge name in many ways and a huge person in stature in many ways, and a chap I've known for a long time, respected for a long time, by the name of Anthony Chadwick. So Anthony, welcome to the show.
Hey, welcome, David. And I've been angling for this invite for ages, so to get on, I feel like I've now finally arrived as a veterinary surgeon.
Let me tell the listeners a little bit about your background. I'm going to keep this brief because I want you to do most of the talking on the show, but and I'm not sure whether to put this in chronological order of when I learned all this stuff about you, because you're like an onion, Anthony. Like, there's many, many layers to the Chadwick onion, I believe. I mean that in a nice way, not in a way that you make people cry.
occasionally.
Yeah. Anthony Chadwick, pioneer of online education. Many people can claim to be in online education, but I don't think there's anybody on the planet that I would think as an individual has done more to contribute and shape the pathway of online learning over the last, it's got to be 15 years now, maybe, right?
We had our 14th birthday in March.
And we're talking about the Webinar Vet. So Anthony's the CEO of the Webinar Vet, which leads into number two thing, which actually, although you're CEO of Webinar Vet, you're definitely one of the most entrepreneurial vets that I know, and have certainly dipped your fingers into many, many pies. And I think that's super impressive. You're a general practitioner and practice owner for a very long time, a dermatologist,
yeah,
taking skin referrals, and a certificate holder in dermatology here in the United Kingdom. An environmentalist is a massive part of your tapestry. Podcaster, musician.
I do like the guitar, it's got to be said.
And bottom of the list, but not necessarily the thing of least importance, Liverpool Football Club lover.
Yes. And we're
fan? Is fan the right word?
Fan. I am a season ticket holder for Liverpool. I was born about half a kilometre from the actual football ground. So I'm, you know, very much allowed to be a supporter. Although Liverpool is an interesting place because I was brought up on a road called Priory Road. And on Priory Road is Stanley Park. And if I'd walked straight, I would have ended up at Everton's ground, which is the second team in Liverpool. But my dad was a Liverpool supporter. Turning left takes you up to Anfield. So it does become, you've got to be careful because it can become an obsession and you can get a bit crotchety when you get beat. But thankfully, it doesn't happen too often. We've won a trophy this year, but of course, Jürgen, our manager, is leaving on Sunday and we've got a new manager starting in August time. So,
all right, let's start there then, because, and aren't Tranmere Rovers the second team in Liverpool?
This is true, or Liverpool Reserves, I think, as Bill Shankly famously said. So I'm kind, I was being kind. I'm really interested, you know, yesterday, and obviously this may be publicised later, but there was a game between Manchester City and Tottenham, and Tottenham had the chance to get into the Champions League if they won that game.
And such a weird game.
Man City will probably win the league. The last game is on Sunday, but they've won this game. They're 2 points clear. probably they're going to win the league. It's not impossible for them to lose it, but it's unlikely. The Tottenham fans know that if Man City lose the league, their neighbours Arsenal will win the league, and they don't want that to happen. So they preferred for their team to get beat and miss out on Champions League football than to actually beat Man City and have that chance to go into Europeans' top competition. And I just find that illogical side. You know, I support my team first and foremost. I'm also a lover of the city of Liverpool. I want Everton to do well. Everton were flirting with relegation again this year. They've managed to get out of that. They beat us at Goodison. They were so pleased. But worry about yourself. And I think sometimes, you know, there is a business side to this, that we can spend so much time worrying about other people and not just spending time concentrating on our own business. And actually, you know, again, not everybody will know who Jurgen Klopp is, but there are a lot of lessons that I learn from football that I actually try to take into business as well. You know, in management, how he's managed the club, how they've managed the club in a sustainable way, using money sensibly, has been, owned by Americans, the Fenway Sports Group, who own the Boston Red Sox. So if people are listening in from America, Boston Red Sox may be a bit more of a familiar name. But they and Jurgen Klopp together have done an excellent job with the club.
So I think it's worth dwelling on that for a second. And notwithstanding that the vast majority of our listeners are from America, we're talking about Premier League football or Premier soccer. League football here,
soccer. Soccer. Let's talk soccer.
Don't tune out on this at the moment, because we're not talking about this for football's sake. But so Jurgen Klopp, and I'm not a Liverpool fan, and I agree with you about last night's match was weird. It does not compute that you would hate another person so much that you would rather you missed out on an amazing, hugely financially lucrative and just phenomenal experience for your club. I mean, it's a walking definition of shooting yourself in the foot and parochialism, if you ask me. And I just don't get that. And I say that as a Celtic fan. I would still cheer, you know, I would never want my team to lose in a situation like that. So that doesn't make sense to me. Anyway, let's come back to Liverpool, because Liverpool are a global brand. I think it is interesting. They're also, you know, their owners own the Boston Red Sox, and I happen to, that's my favorite baseball team. And there's a lot of parallels between those two clubs in terms of the depth, the fanaticism of their support base, the success dating back through the decades, the stars, the global icons of the game that existed in both clubs, the really ancient, slightly rickety vibe of their stadium. They've been around for a very long time. Yes. Fenway Park's an amazing place, and Boston's an amazing city. But Jurgen Klopp, I have a massive man crush on Jurgen Klopp. I mean, it's really hard not to have a man crush on him, because he's just such a likable, you get the sense that he'd be a brilliant leader, a brilliant manager, and you can see that the players like go the extra distance for that guy. So I'm kind of interested from your point of view as a season ticket holder and somebody much closer to Liverpool than I am, what's the magic that Klopp has brought to the club? And boy, how hard is this transition going to be now? Like, I feel bereavement that he's leaving Liverpool, because it feels like it's become a constant, and he's not going to be in our TV screens, and we're not going to hear from Klopp as much now. And it would feel weird him managing somebody else. It's like when Martin O'Neill left Celtic. It was like, this is wrong. Yeah. This guy's meant to be here. What did he do to transform the fortunes of Liverpool? And I want to think about this, not just from the football point of view, but the lessons you mentioned already about bringing that into your business life and how we might all learn something from this. What's your perspective?
I think when he came in, we were not in a good place. I don't think we'd been in European football for a number of years. And I think the first thing he did was he said he was coming to be the ordinary one, not the special one, but he was coming to create memorable moments. So it was going to be fun. He was going to entertain people. And I think in those early days, they're very much, you know, it was heavy metal football and the games were exciting, lots of goals, etc. So he endeared himself to the fans, because I think every fan, you want your team to win, but you want it to be done in an entertaining way as well. I mean, again, we've seen just recently West Ham have sacked David Moyes, who's been probably their most successful manager ever. There's no logic in that, because he's been very successful for them, but they would say he's not been giving them exciting football. Whereas I think that's something that we've always done. I mean, a couple of days ago, a 3-3 draw, you know, as he draws to the end of his career, we still have this exciting football that he produces. I think then he knows how to get the best out of people. He demands the best from people. He knows when to put an arm around them. He knows when to, you know, have a word and tell them that they can do better. So having that sort of carrot and stick mentality, I think, is important. I think he also brings around really talented people around him. So Liverpool has become a bit like Boston Red Sox, very data-driven. So we commonly come, you know, in the top three in the league every year now under Jurgen Klopp. And yet the money that we've spent on transfers puts us about 13th or 14th in the league. So we get real value for money. The business is run sustainably. It's not run as a plaything for, you know, a Russian oligarch or whatever. And by doing it that way and passing over, football managers and football players can be a bit egotistical, but he's actually able to have that humility of saying, right, we'll have a transfer committee. I won't always get my own way. Let's look at this from a very data-driven way. And I think, you know, as a digital business, that's something that I admire and that we need to, you know, aspire to as well, that the data is out there, but it's how you bring it together. That important backroom team, you can't do this on your own. And I think also bringing realism in, because he talks about football being the most important of the least important things. You can have people who become obsessed with what is basically a sport and it's a hobby and it becomes their life. And I think that's not healthy for anybody if you're obsessed with something.
That sounds a bit familiar. I can think of another group of people that have that issue going on.
Go on.
Veterinarians.
Well, yeah, we can definitely obsess, can't we? It becomes vocational, doesn't it, for a lot of
people. Yeah, and it's not a hobby. So that's an interesting word in itself, though, Anthony. You know, I think for you and for I, it was sold to me as a vocation. I remember very clearly sitting in a car driving from, you know, my home into, I think we were going to do the shopping on a Saturday morning, and having a conversation, and my parents were talking about, you know, careers and things, and I mentioned wanting to be a vet, and that sounded like the first non-ridiculous idea I had, and we were talking about it, and that was the first time I heard the word vocation. And they were saying, he said, look, you go to university and do a law degree or do biology or something like that, but you're probably not going to do law or biology after that. Most people don't. But if you go to university and you do veterinary medicine or dentistry, you are going to do that. That's going to be your career. That's it. And that was very much my mindset going in there, that it was a vocation. But, and this might be some of the difference between generations, or it might just be me, to be perfectly honest, but I never felt like it was my whole identity. It was a vocation, but I still had a lot of other things that were important to me as well. Whereas now I feel like the general sense is that it's not seen as a vocation. It's not seen in such a level of way of commitment that perhaps we saw it, but there is a stronger connection to a sense of identity, or a struggle with, when there is a struggle with being a vet, of a collapsing sense of identity and the impacts on mental well-being, ego, etc. that follow on from that.
It's interesting. I remember, and I can't remember who the quote was from, but it was basically, you know, the young people today aren't nearly as resilient and as good as we were in our day. And it was very much from, I think it was from a Greek philosopher or something. So clearly, right. I always feel, do we understand young people enough? And I want to be supportive of them. But of course, if you're too supportive, and I think this is the danger, we did several years ago a mindfulness course. Royal College had set up an initiative called the Mind Matters Initiative, recognizing that there was stress in the profession. And I said, well, it's great to have this, but, you know, what are we going to do practically about it? And we ran an 8-week course on mindfulness. Some of the American listeners may remember, because it actually went worldwide and people were using it. Pharmaceutical companies, I remember the Critical Care Association in America bought it for all their emergency vets. We had, you know, kennel maids, vets, nurses, receptionists using it. And when I walk around conferences, not as much now because it's been a little while ago, but I would often get stopped and people would say, you know, we love your clinical material, but actually this has changed my life. I'm not shouting at my nurses. I've gone on holiday. I've been able to relax and so on. So I think putting things in place is really good, but of course we can get to the stage where if we support people too much, they become dependent as well. And that is a concern. And I think if you aren't as vocational, if you're, and I think you're right, you know, my sense is that this generation is not as vocational as we were. I mean, I don't practice veterinary medicine still, but I still see that, you know, part of my DNA is that I'm a vet and I'm obviously still involved in the profession. So I think that if we can come at the profession and realize what a fantastic job it is and how fortunate we are to do what we do, then I think some of the mental health issues disappear if we focus on others rather than ourselves. You know, it is a tough job, but then there are lots of other tough jobs out there that probably don't pay nearly as well as we get paid. And are we the best paid? No, we're not. But we're doing something that's really important, both for the animals, hopefully for the planet as well, but also for people. You know, we see how attached people are to their pets and how much of a difference it can make in people's lives, lowering stress. A lady, you know, living on her own after her husband has died, that pet is so, so important to her. And we're very privileged that we're in that position that we can help. I think it does help as a vet if you love people as well as loving, you know, the animals. But it really is an interesting area. But I think a lot of it is around if we can be grateful for the small things, then life doesn't feel as difficult as maybe it does when we think that life is a bit unfair on us.
Do you have any... There's sort of two little threads I wanted to pull on there. I wondered if you might be able to expand upon, you said, helping people to focus more on others than themselves. I'm curious to dig into that a little bit more and your thoughts on that. I'm also curious about, do you have any habits or processes in place that you have to manage stress, like mindfulness or other things? So maybe if we take both of those in turn, and I'll try and not forget I asked the second part.
Yeah, I remember doing an exercise when I still had my practice. You know, I'd been through a bit of a rough time. My wife had left me and that was a really tough time for me. But, you know, everybody has crosses in their life and it's about how you respond to those and how you get around them. And as part of that process, I went through a thing, the E-Myth by Michael Gerber. And there was a 3-year course that I went on. Part of that at the beginning was, what's your primary aim? What are you about in life? What do you want to accomplish? And mine was love and serve. Mm. And so that is really at the heart of what I do. Do I get it right all the time? No. But it's what I aim to do. And I do get a kick out of helping people. And it does make me feel better about myself. That's obviously coming from, you know, an upbringing of being brought up as a Catholic. It's very much, you know, being familiar with the Bible and seeing what are the things that, and they're in all religions, but most religions talk about, you know, helping others. So I think that is why I probably ended up in a career in the caring industries. And, you know, things like going to Mass, you know, I go to Mass every Sunday, and just that hour of quiet, of time to contemplate, as well as, you know, other times when I might pray, I think a lot of people are missing out on that. We have lost faith as a generation. You know, less people go to church, less people believe in God. And that for me is a center point, because for me, I also think that there's stuff going to happen after I die. And I think if you don't have a belief in God and you see it as, you know, I might live 70, 80 years and then I die, that to me feels a bit depressing. Particularly as you get older, you know, when you're 20, it probably doesn't matter as much. But when you're, you know, coming close to your 60s and then into your 70s, then you realize that you haven't got long left. It doesn't mean that I don't take this time seriously and I want to make a difference now. But I think having that eternal perspective makes me much more hopeful about general life anyway.
Yeah, if you've got a fork in the road,
yeah,
there's three ways to go, isn't there? Yeah, but only one of them sounds fun.
Yeah, exactly. So I think when people have something that they can hold on to, and you know, in my case, it's my faith, it makes life much easier for it to be fun. And then to be grateful about, you know, sometimes small things. So I often practice in the morning, you know, just that gratitude of what am I happy about. I find going out in nature is a big thing for me, you know, enjoying animals. Even, you know, I do the 5K run. I'm not quite at your level now. I used to run a lot, but obviously as you get older, it's a bit more difficult and the times deteriorate. But the fact that on a Saturday morning, I can go out and run 5K, I'm supremely grateful about that because I know at some point in the future, I may not be able to do it. So it's really important to enjoy it in the here and now. I've also got glaucoma, present from my mum and dad and my granddad, you know, so it's a familial trait. And sometimes health is wasted on the youth, isn't it? Because, you know, up to 40, 46, I had like perfect eyesight. And then I was seeing my auntie who was unfortunately dying in Australia. And she said, your eyes look a mess. You should go and see an optician. Never been to an optician because my eyes were so good. And then he said, oh, actually, you know, your right eye looks a bit screwed. And you know, the back of the eye. And, you know, I still see quite well. I'm really blessed to see really well. But actually, again, it makes you appreciate sight when you think there's a possibility of losing it. So I suppose my advice to people, you know, particularly younger people, is just practicing gratitude is a great way of lifting the mood if you feel a bit down in the dumps. I'm not saying that I'm never down in the dumps because, you know, everybody is. But I think on the whole, I've got a positive attitude to life, which I think goes a long way.
I want to come into talking about, because you've got, I think there's a couple of perspectives I'm very keen to explore with you. One from your viewpoint as, I think somebody who's looking at the big picture a lot and thinking about where your business is, but also that's not in isolation, that's in the bigger picture of veterinary medicine as they serve veterinary medicine, going, I do want to talk quite a lot about the sustainability work that you do. But perhaps a nice segue between both is that point you came to of just having time in nature and exercise and building gratitude. And I actually didn't, I wasn't aware of the sort of faith element that you have. And so that now that all ties together in the Camino de Santiago. And
yeah,
that's a walk that I've actually, I did the West Highland Way with my dad in 2021. And I was just thinking about it yesterday, how amazing an experience that was and how my dad's wife was absolutely certain that we would kill each other before we'd even got off the train in Mogai, where the start point is. And it couldn't have been further from the truth. It was an absolutely, you know, I'll look back in years to come and I'll be so happy I did that. And I thought I'd really like to do the Camino de Santiago. And I just am reminded of that because my dad did that, the West Highland Way, and then he went to do a bit of the Camino with my grandfather. And they went up this hill and my grandfather just about collapsed. And he said, what's wrong? And he said, well, I've got a pretty serious heart condition. And I told him about. And in the thin air, he hadn't even thought to mention it. And my dad thought, this is daft. But the Camino de Santiago sounds like a very, very spiritual place where people go often to learn something about themselves or find isolation. So there's a real sense of the Camino being this missionary pilgrimage, if you will, trail. What was your motivation to do it? And, you know, what was your experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's pilgrimage. And obviously the word pilgrimage, I think French is peregrine. And peregrine is all about walking, peregrination. So I think it's that process of walking and slowing down and having time to think and to talk and being challenged as well, you know. So there is probably a penitential side, but a challenging side to it. I mean, the northwest of Spain is very similar to the northwest of England. It rains a lot, and it rained a lot during that week. There's no such thing as bad weather. There's only bad clothes. So luckily, I was fairly well attired and got away with it. But when it is absolutely chucking down and you've still got 10 kilometers to walk, you know, you do think, why am I doing this? And again, it talks a lot about, you know, not grumbling about things, but actually just getting on and seeing the positive in things as well. My wife has a friend who's been on the Camino on a number of occasions. And the friend said, I am going to organize a tour, you know, I'm going to organize a little group and we'll do it together, which I think makes it two different ways. You could obviously do it on your own or you can do it in a small group. And so the group came together and it ended up Dave, being myself and my wife and eight women. So I was very, very much outnumbered and, as you can imagine, thoroughly bullied in the whole process. But I've lived to tell the tale. No, seriously, it was...
I loved every second.
It was really good. And the interesting thing is that the group splits up. It goes at different paces. You can stop, you can start. So, and you get to know people. Obviously, how often do we spend, even this here now, you know, spending an hour talking, we get to know each other better than if we're, you know, at a conference and we've got 10 minutes before the next meeting or whatever. And even the face-to-face, you know, the importance of, when I want to really get to know somebody in the profession, it's almost, you know, or a client, sitting down and having a meal with them is completely different than, you know, being at the conference center and there's maybe a coffee and you've got, you know, you've got 20 minutes and that's it kind of thing.
Everything's so superficial and almost performative in those moments.
And everybody's rushing. So I think the Camino and any walking, you know, I like to walk anyway. So I don't think it has to be a religious element, but obviously the Camino is all about, it's the Santiago de Compostela is where St. James's body is, where he was found in a sort of wood, and there was light in the wood evidently, and somebody went and dug in a spot and they found this body and they realized it was probably St. James. So Santiago de Compostela, the Compostela is the field of stars. And obviously Santiago is St. James in Spanish. So being there in a place with somebody who was actually, you know, lived and spent time with Jesus is obviously for, you know, any Christian is, I think, something that people would, you know, feel some sort of closeness there and some sort of, you know, a warm feeling from doing that. But I do think, you know, life is very, very busy and we do need times when we take time away. And that week was, you know, was amazing. 126 kilometers, you know, challenging with some hills, with rain, etc., but with lots of laughter and a lot of good conversations and a lot of opportunity to go deeper and to, you know, to think about things as well. And I think as leaders, you know, I should have corrected you before. I'm the chief veterinary officer now at the Webinar Vet because Catherine is CEO. And the danger that I find sometimes is, she spends so much time in meetings, but you actually have to have time where, you know, you're sitting on your bike and when you're biking, some of those problems that you've been thinking about get solved, don't they? Or, you know, you're having a walk or just a coffee sitting on the step or, you know, in your garden where you just want to have some thinking time to go over things. And I think perhaps as leaders, we don't always stop and think enough, do we?
It's a real curse for us, particularly if you've been a veterinarian beforehand, because your whole life, it felt like you were being naughty if you were sitting down and just taking five to yourself, because it's just nonstop. And I certainly found that now, I mean, I set aside Fridays where I don't take meetings, I don't do anything on a Friday except give myself space to do things that nurture me. And I know some of that's learning and reading, but some of that is, it's just hanging out and doing stuff that's just completely mindless, but in actual fact, completely mindful or some exercise. And you're right. The number of times a problem that kept you up at 4 a.m, suddenly you just think, oh, well, that's easy. Just do this. Anthony, I've got a photo for you, which will be.
Yes, very similar attire, but you look as if you're staying dry. That's the main thing.
Yeah. So I'm holding up a picture and if you're not watching a recording of this, then it's me on the West Highland Way, and I would be drier if I jumped in a swimming pool. There is no question. And I'd have been warmer as well, but I would not have changed a second of it. Type 2 fun. I only recently came to learn the phrase type 2 fun, Anthony.
Well, I can kind of get it, but go on, tell me what it is.
It's the sort of fun that you're having that at the time you mostly feel like, why the hell did I choose to do this? I want to vomit, or I want this to stop immediately. That once you get done with it right after, you're like, oh, how'd I do it again? You know, marathon running of any kind, potentially is long, but spending camping, being out in the wild, triathlon, all of that stuff.
It's all challenging stuff. And actually, if we don't challenge ourselves. I was talking to one of my team recently, and he felt that I was being a bit rude and unkind to him. And I said, no, I'm actually challenging you to become better. You know, so actually we do need to challenge ourselves and, you know, and challenge each other in business. And you obviously have to do it in a kind way. And, I obviously try and do that. So I apologized if he felt I was being unkind. But if we don't challenge ourselves and challenge other people, we tend to grow most in difficult situations, don't we? If life is perfect, there's no need to grow. You know, the whole idea of pruning is painful because you're having branches cut off, but it actually encourages new growth, doesn't it?
100%. So, okay, well, there's another thread we could pull on then, because one of the points of this podcast is to try and learn from our guests how to be better versions of ourselves. So I'm, you know, you've been on this very deep learning journey. I think that's one thing that always jumps out about you in my head is your curiosity, and whether that's, you know, that's taken you to explore online education, but it's taken you to explore augmented reality in education. It's taken you to explore the spirituality of religion. You know, and obviously all of these things you do with the other businesses you're involved in, it takes a lot of curiosity is a big thing. But learning and growth is the word that you mentioned there. I'm wondering, what is your approach to learning or to actually just problem solving generally?
Yeah.
There's a lot of different questions. So there's maybe question one about learning development. What is your process? But then I'm kind of interested to segue after that into how do you, because learning happens when you think of a problem. You're like, oh, I need to learn about that. It's part of the selection of what you're going to determine what gets your attention for the next weeks, months, or years as well when you're choosing a next project. So those two feel very interlinked to me. So take a stab at that, however you feel. But I think it's the learning growth and then the how do you select problems and projects to work on?
Probably need to go back to when I was very young, and my parents and people who interacted with me told me that I was a very annoying child, because the question that I most liked to ask was why.
Yeah.
And they would then go, well, they'd try and explain. I'd go, well, why? And, you know, you can go deeper and deeper into those whys, can't you? So I was very curious about stuff. And I think I've kept that curiosity. And I think it's just about being a lifelong learner. Your curriculum is a bit constrained when you're at school, because obviously they've got to teach you certain things, you know, which I think is right and proper. And then you go to university, and again, you're learning, you know, very much from a curriculum which the university sets. And I've really enjoyed the fact that once I left university, I could pick my own curriculum. Mm-hmm. So when I left, obviously you spend the first year sort of wondering how on earth you're going to do this job, you know, because it's so difficult. You know, you've learned a bit at university, but you don't really know a lot. And then suddenly things start dropping into place. And, you know, for me, the first thing was, oh, I know nothing about dermatology. This is embarrassing. I better get better at it. And went to some courses. And, you know, within a short length of time, I'd got a certificate. And I think it is having focus. And if I would probably say I've lost some of that focus because of all the distractions now. I do think social media and the internet, there's loads of blessings in that. But there's certainly difficulties with focus, although it is something that I'm aware of. So, you know, I know how to kind of deal with it. But I think the why is really important. Setting your own curriculum, you know, what really fascinates you, what you're passionate about, do what you love. If you're in a job that you hate, then you should leave it. But if you're doing something that you love, then it's so much easier to learn, isn't it? And, you know, I've been very blessed. You know, I wanted to be a vet from when I was 8. Didn't get in first time, you know, had to redo A-levels and things, but got in. You know, was an average student at university, passed when I needed to pass things and got through. But I think if some people will stop learning, you know, we'll all have colleagues and friends who've kind of stopped learning, and then you catch up and you go past them and you get cleverer and cleverer as you get older because you know more, you make more connections, and you start to sort of, I feel I've got a bit of an holistic viewpoint on most things, that most things are connected. So when I was young, people would say, well, you know, you want to be a vet because you love animals more than people. And I said, no, I absolutely, you know, animals are so much part of that picture with people, you know, as companions, but also supporting us, you know, to do work. Obviously, you know, some of us eat animals as well. and then realizing, you know, the planet, even, you know, 30, 40 years ago was in a bit of a mess. So I think it's about not giving up on learning and then what you're passionate about, you know, learn more. But in the busyness of being a vet practice, sometimes that can, you know, finding that time to do it, sometimes you need to step back a bit. And it was probably going into Webinar Vet, you know, 14 years ago, I'd always, with my dermatology, like to do lectures and give back. But actually lecturing on something really solidifies your knowledge on it. So if you've learned something and you've learned it and then you move on, yeah, you remember bits of it. But if you learn something and then you go and lecture on it, then that really solidifies your knowledge. Obviously, it's great from a marketing perspective as well. So I think doing that was important. And then obviously, when I started Webinar Vet, that was very much just out of curiosity. A lot of vets go to veterinary conferences. That's kind of where vets will usually be found. Actually, it's much, you find a lot less vets at internet conferences or at sustainability conferences. And I find it really fascinating sometimes to go outside of the profession and see what's going on the outside. Because sometimes the future of the veterinary profession is already in the present somewhere else. So if we can stay curious, you know, I'm an avid reader of the Harvard Business Review. Again, it's not a veterinary magazine, but I think we open ourselves up to so much more. And to them connecting those dots where you start saying, oh, actually, you know, the reason that I started Webinar Vet was I went to the internet conference and there was a guy talking about webinars. And I thought, do you know what? Nobody's doing this. The traditional CPD companies are out there. They should be doing this, but they're not doing it. And it is difficult, I think, for a traditional business to be disruptive of itself. So you do need people to come from the outside. And I think the curiosity, seeing it as a big problem point for me, you know, trying to do your training in a way that didn't cost huge amounts of money, huge amounts of time away from practice and from family, huge amounts of carbon as well. It just seemed to me, gosh, this is something we should be doing. And when I walked around BSAVA conference in 2010 and said to companies, you should be doing webinars, people said, you know, what's a webinar? Right. Because, of course, we weren't talking about it in the veterinary profession. We need people who go outside to come back in again. Yeah. Because we can be quite conservative and can think that we have everything we need. I think we're getting better at that. I think there are a lot more younger vets who go plural and do other things and are much more curious about the outside world outside of veterinary. So for me, it's about being a lifelong learner, being curious, looking outside the normal places, because you'll find really fascinating things when you delve a bit more deeply on the periphery.
Yeah, that may be one of the plus points, because nothing's entirely negative. And maybe one of the plus points about less of a vocational focus is that willingness, yes, to go outside, explore and innovate. And there certainly seems to be more willingness to do that, which if it comes back into veterinary medicine, will certainly be useful. Innovation's a word there, and I'll maybe come on to that in a second. So, and maybe this sort of helps talk about that sort of selection of projects then that you might, like when you're out there reading the Harvard Business Review, or, you know, and you have a lot of projects, you know, whether it's your active things you've built or you've acquired and brought into the family of business products that you're offering, you know, there must be your inbox must look like my inbox, and people, yeah, just pitching stuff to you or asking for your attention on this. How do you spend your time? You know, we talked about distraction earlier. There's so many things. Frankly, there's entry-level things that are like scrolling reels of, yeah, hilarious stuff that Instagram shows you as a time killer. There's internal things in your business that are time killers, like endless meetings where you talk about stuff but nothing gets done.
Yeah.
But then there's external, ooh, shiny stuff things, which for people who are interested in entrepreneurship and innovation and things are almost the worst thing of all, but also could be the best thing, yeah, of, yeah, all. Whether that's a project to work on or an investment or something like that. How do you go about allocating time and making sure that you're maximizing your use of time?
And we all procrastinate and waste time, but what I find kind of works for me is trying to box things off into different days. So I tend to have Monday as a internal meetings. Tuesday will be more thinking about strategic things and spending some time, you know, on other projects and stuff that I want to look at more deeply. Wednesday is content. So I do a lot of the podcasting on a Wednesday, writing emails. I mean, sometimes that breaks down a bit, but on the whole, it's what I try to do. And then Thursday, I try and have, you know, external meetings with clients, et cetera, or prospective clients. And then Friday is often just pulling things together. Am I as disciplined as I should be, you know, looking at emails later on in the evening? No, I sometimes fall into that, but I'm aware that that's a problem. And I think it's really important on the whole in the evenings, I try and relax. I'm doing a certificate at the moment with Cambridge University on circularity and circular economy. So, you know, that's where it's really important to have that time where you can say, well, this is my strategic time and this is something I think is important. We're doing a conference on it in about a month's time down in London at a nature reserve. And so I need to think that I'm kind of on top, or at least, you know, a few pages ahead of other people coming to the conference who are also, you know, interested in sustainability as well.
All right, I'll bite on that. Tell me more. Not just about the conference, but about the concept. Let's go there.
Yeah. So I've always been really fascinated by nature, and very early days, I was in fourth year, fifth year senior school, and I was doing conservation conferences for sixth formers and things, you know, so we get sixth formers in. So it's always been a passion. I've kind of realized, and it wasn't so much global warming then, it was just things like, you know, elephants being slaughtered and all that sort of stuff, and whales being killed and so on. So I've always been passionate about those areas, you know, supporting them charitably if I can. And also trying to do that in my life, you know, use less plastic, eat meat that is more sustainably produced, look at packaging, etc. Hey. And, you know, obviously less processed food, obviously eating vegetarian as well. You know, we do eat quite a lot of vegetarian in the house. Solar panels for the last 14 years on the roof because it was just the right thing to do. It's now the right thing to do from an economic perspective as well. So that's been a big passion project for a long time. And then obviously I started Webinar Vet, and very quickly I realized that we were, you know, saving a lot of mileage off the roads and off the airways because people were going to the conference, weren't going to the conference, they were using the online training as well. So yeah, we think we've saved many millions of miles off the roads. And I kind of rest on my laurels because I thought, you know what, we're doing this great thing. And actually, I've been doing this course with Cambridge, and I've now realized that they talk about it as the Resolve framework. And the V stands for virtualization. So once you virtualize something, you obviously make it much more circular.
Can I butt in there? And sorry to interrupt. Can you take us through what is circularity as a concept and then hit us with this, the framework?
Yeah. So I'll probably start by saying, sustainability, the UN definition is that we leave the planet in the same state as we started there, you know, for future generations. So that's what sustainability is all about. And actually, I now talk about we're not at the point where we can sustain the planet. We actually have to regenerate it, hence regenerative agriculture and so on.
Right. And you wrote in a blog, and this was back in 2022, sustainability is no longer enough. Incremental improvements are no longer enough. Fancy words at government conferences are no longer enough. All industries need to think about in a transformative way to make sure the temperature does not go 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial temperatures, which looks like that's a pipe dream at this point in time.
Yeah. As I said before, I'm a man of hope. And I think we can turn this ship around. However, I'm amazed by how difficult it is to get people into a room for our Veterinary Green Discussion Forum. We do get a good group, but people aren't taking this as seriously. Big and small business are not taking this as seriously as they should, from all sorts of areas. And I can give you loads of examples. But talking about circularity is all about, how do we begin to create circular systems that recycle? Now, recycle.
Don't waste.
Yeah, recycle is the obvious one, but actually, you're looking at before that. Because if you recycle, you know, one of these iPhones and you smash it up and you get the rare metals out of it, then there's probably 1% circularity in that. Whereas if you take that phone and you tidy it up and you repurpose it and you sell it cheaper, then it prolongs its life. So circularity is all about prolonging life rather than fast fashion and throwing things away.
Yes.
But it's also about reusing. So, for example, when we had our kitchen redone, 16, 17-year-old kitchen, it was starting to look its age. We wanted to redo it. And we also wanted to bring electric hobs in, you know, induction hobs, because that's I'm trying to decarbonize my own house. So having gas in the house, obviously, a lot of my energy comes from, well, all of my energy comes from sustainable sources in the electricity, either because of the supplier, which is good energy, which only does sustainable energy, but also my solar panels that are on the roof give me my hot water and they give me my electricity when the sun shines. And then I have a battery, which means that of an evening, you know, in the summer, the battery runs my house for me. So that is also an example of a circular system in that it's not just using things. So linear economy is very much we manufacture something, we use it, we throw it away. And actually, we're finding more and more now that that is wasteful and it actually costs money and it actually makes economic sense to go circular. But obviously, it's difficult because we need government support for that. We need management and business support for that. We can use technology to help us with that as well. But circularity is one of the enablers of sustainability. It's not the whole thing. But I actually think, as I've understood it more, it does come in with that very much holistic approach, because it's also looking from the other side at how do we create circular agricultural systems. If you think about it, going back 100 years, we used to have rotation of crops.
Yes.
That was very, very circular. And then we stopped using that and we started using more chemical fertilizer. That fertilizer then runs into the rivers and causes eutrophication. That causes death of the river. That causes death of the animals in the river. So you can see that that's not a circular thing, that if you do that for too long, you end up with no rivers, you know, no food in the rivers. And obviously that's going to cause us problems.
Massive algal blooms
Off the
sea that we can see right now.
So the more that we think about how do we make sure that we can turn this into a circle rather than a straight line, and thinking about it, you know, in our own industry, again, going back 30 years, you know, and I'm not saying we should do it, but we used to boil our plastic syringes and use them again, you know, in the practice that I was a young boy at in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Okay, how can we know now that Becton Dickinson do a syringe that's 30% less plastic that's being recycled? There are 460 million tons of plastic produced every year, and most of it is from virgin material. Now, plastic obviously has its advantages, but we're now beginning to see the curse of plastic and how it can be a really negative material. But the first stage is actually, how do we take that plastic? How can we reuse it? So really good video I saw from Renault. They're taking cars at the end of the life, and they're reusing as many components as they can, and they're repurposing the car. So the car goes out again. It's not a brand new car because it's got bits from all different cars. But that bumper that was going to get thrown away actually can be reused. We have Petplan come to the Veterinary Green Discussion Forum. They're part of a bigger insurance company called Allianz. Allianz now realized how important that mitigation is, because flooding is becoming more common. So they have to look at how they're going to prevent flooding, because they know that, you know, that pricing is going to go up because of all the floods that people have. But they also know that a car's 10-year-old car has been in an accident and its bumper's been damaged. It's fender, I think, in American. You know, you actually can find an old bumper somewhere and put that on rather than put a new one on. So all of these things, they're small things, but if we all start to think in a more circular way, I think the effect can be massive. And I know, you know, in America, there's controversy around things like global warming and whether it's a problem or whether it's a cyclical thing or whatever. But we all know that when the forests burned in Canada last year, they were the biggest fires in Canada's history, times seven. an area the size of half of the United Kingdom went up in smoke and was destroyed. Now, forest fires are a normal part of what happens in Canada, but these were, you know, at a magnitude that's never been experienced before. And those fires then drifted smoke into places like Toronto, into New York, into Boston, into Chicago. And people were having respiratory problems, and presumably some people died because of those respiratory problems. So when we look at it in a circle, and when we look at it holistically, we realize that, you know, whether oil is or not causing global warming, there has to be ways that we have to start looking at some of these areas, because they're causing, you know, not just problems in the environment, but they're causing problems for ourselves now as well. You see the massive floods. They had massive floods in Dubai. You know, it's a desert. So we just need to start looking and moving quicker. So I am a bit anxious, because I don't think we're moving quickly enough. But what I'm trying to do, and there's other people, you know, I think the key here is that not one person is ever going to solve this problem, but a number of people coming together can make a difference. And sometimes it's a bit like with the iPhone. You need the early adopters to start things. And then everybody wants an iPhone, apart from the laggards like your dad who doesn't believe in them. But you need to have that start where people begin to see that this is easy, and government make it easy through subsidies, through setting up recycling systems that work. So we need government, we need business, and we need individuals to all work together. But we can't, as an individual or as a business, we shouldn't be waiting for government. We just need to crack on. And government in the end is often populist and will follow the crowd, won't it?
Absolutely. I'm minded of the Rabbi Burns, many meekles does a muckle mac.
Yeah.
And lots of littles makes a big. Yeah. And you're right. Like, you know, the issue is so politicized, and that therefore toxifies it into further culture warring, which is really only for the benefit of political ideology and power and control. But ultimately, there is no shortage of evidence that, whether that is in the form of, you know, interclimate panel of scientists publishing data, or frankly witnessing the massive heat domes that are appearing more frequently, and they kill lots of people sitting over the northwest of Pacific coast of America. You know, the movement of the jet stream brought us pretty inclement weather for all of last year are all things. It's easy, it's denialism to put your head in the sand and think, well, I'm going to be dead, it doesn't matter, but it really does. So Anthony, and I had a fabulous discussion previously on blunt dissection, and there's obviously groups within veterinary medicine working on the problem, but it's also, and I put my hand up and say, you know, guilty here, you have invited me to the you know, to your sustainability forum. And now I get to feel even more guilty, because not only did I not go, but I'm not going because I'm on a plane traveling to America. So now I feel like a massive asshole.
Well, but it is difficult. We're all a bit hypocritical, but you also have to justify things. You know, I went down to South Africa to the WVA to talk about sustainability. My friends laugh at me about that. But, you know, if we can get more people thinking in a sustainable way, if we can get more people using Webinar Vet as a platform, it's virtualizing learning, which means that it will probably be less sort of damaging to the environment than going to a conference. But as you delve deep, you realize, and this is part of the reason for the Veterinary Green Discussion Forum, because I think conversation often is too binary. I'm right, you're wrong. Whereas as you delve, and we see this in political debate, you know, you're either a right winger or a left winger, whereas actually, we shouldn't be defined by that. We should listen to each other and learn from each other.
Yeah.
And I find that as you sort of listen more, you realize, oh, okay, so I'm doing all this learning online, but obviously we're now in a position where so much information is online that we need these huge data centers. And for example, the Republic of Ireland now puts more of its energy into data centers than it does into its urban housing.
Yeah.
So we have to look at, you know, these things that happen, and we need to solve these things with, you know, renewable energy and so on. Do we need to store all those emails that we get, or can we delete them? So I'm on a journey of that because that's something fairly new for me that I'm now discovering. You know, all of the e-waste from computers, how can we deal with them better? How we actually moved out of the office when COVID hit. So we had a lot of desktop computers and I was able to donate them to my wife's school. And because money in education is very tight, those computers were much better than what they had at their own place. But we've given it a new life. So it's extended the life. You know, it's another example of circularity. And as you begin to think about it, you know, circle is, it's quite intuitive. And I think most people kind of get it once they spend some time thinking about it.
No, thank you for diving into that in a bit more detail. Our last podcast guest was Jeremy Watson, who was, I think, he had the first practice to get to net zero.
Yeah.
And is in Australia. And that was a really fascinating episode. So you can sort of see there's a slight climate bent on the episodes.
Brilliant. And for good reason, actually presenting virtually, digitally at the WVA, because he's part of the FCA, which is Vets for Climate Action. Jeanette Kessel set that up. Yes. And I met Jeanette for the first time properly, if you like, face-to-face rather than virtually in Cape Town. And actually, it was really powerful because we were able to have meetings with some of the government ministers about the whole area of, you know, of climate change and how we can be more circular. You know, as a veterinary profession, I think we've got a duty to lead on that, because if we're not interested in this area of environmentalism, then we can't really expect the lawyers, you know, and the bankers to be interested.
No, and oftentimes, you know, you and I did most of our work in small animal practice, and it's easy to think, well, but what does it mean to small animal practice? You think, aside from plastic and something, you think, well, actually the veterinary sector is responsible for putting food on the plates of virtually the whole developed world. So we do have, and we should be leading by example. All right, so next sustainability conference, Anthony, when is it? Who do you want around the table? How do we get everybody there?
It's coming up pretty soon. We've run it for the last 2 years up in Preston at a nature reserve. I think it's really important to hold this sort of event in a nature reserve because you get grounded in nature. You realize this is what we need to save. And it's a not-for-profit carbon neutral event. And actually, off the back of the first 2 years, we've been able to help the Lancashire Wildlife Trust to be financed to rewild 30 hectares of exhausted livery pasture. So it's great that, as well as it being a discussion forum, I don't want it to become a chat shop. It must have an action at the end. And this is, again, it's actually a methodology from the Young Christian Students, which was all about see, discern or judge and then act. You know, so you look at a problem, you kind of spend some time thinking about it and how it's happened and, you know, what are the causes and how can it maybe be solved? And then you go on and act and make a difference. So it was really satisfying after only 2 years to see that we've had some sort of effect. But what was also really powerful in those 2 years is the networks, people meeting up, continuing the conversation. The first Vet for Natural England was at the conference. They met up with Lancashire Wildlife Trust. They're starting to do work together. Different people are talking, you know, within the veterinary industry as well. So it takes time, but we haven't got a huge amount of time. So I'm a bit impatient. But the next meeting is in London because a lot of people kind of don't want to come up to the frozen north where all the people are savages. So we've brought it down to London, to the London Wetland Centre. It's the 18th, 19th of June. If anybody is interested in attending, you know, please do contact me if this podcast goes out before that time. We're starting to internationalize it. So we've got some international delegates, attendees, participants, because everybody's a participant at this conference. There's, you know, 60, 70 people. It's not a big conference because we want it to be intimate. And hopefully next year we take it into Europe, to France. Seva Animal Health have been really supportive of it, have really felt that what we were trying to do was important, encouraging other people to come as well. And they've built a very sustainable building at their headquarters. The fact that it's in Bordeaux in a major wine producing area is of no importance to me, Dave.
None.
There is a rumour that I like my red and white wine. I mean, it's only a rumour. is merely a rumor. If anybody asks me, I'm just going to say no comment.
It's only a rumor because we can't hear the actual statement over the slurping noises of the wine being guzzled.
Listen, it's 20 past 12. There is no wine on the table here, I can promise you. It's coffee and water. The coffee has been drunk. There's a bit of water there. The red nose is due to my cough and my cold at the moment rather than through any imbibing of excessive alcohol.
So 18th, 19th of June. Oh, you mentioned a framework, actually. Before we leaf on there, it began in V. Was it wasn't victorious, was it?
It was resolve. Now, I think I know this, but I've got my notes. I just want to make sure I don't cock up on
it. It had a V in it. I was close. That's
so the exam. The R stands for regenerative. So regenerate. Yep. So, you know, circularity also involves that we've got to get back some of our nature. So in the UK, and I think in Europe, there is a concept called 30 by 30, which means that by 2030, 30% of our land is of good biodiverse value. I'm conscious that UK is really poor in this area. We're the least wooded in Europe. I think we are the poorest in the G7 on the biodiversity front. We have lovely national parks, but a lot of them are overgrazed by sheep. They become a monoculture of grass. And actually, you don't get a lot of wildlife in that area. The next one is share. So it's talking about, you know, and this is a real mindset change. We own a car, but do we need a car when actually 90% of the time it's sitting outside either our house or our office? So, you know, things like Uber, Airbnb are all examples of the sharing economy. How do we optimize things? So that can be making products more durable so they last longer. It can also be about, for example, you know, before the pandemic even, we were using Zoom to digitalize meetings. You know, particularly a first meeting, don't need to meet face-to-face. You want to have a chat with us. We want to show you what Webinar Vet can do. That's a very digital company. Let's have a meeting on Zoom. If this is of interest to you, then of course we don't mind taking a train down to London. But actually, you know, does every meeting need to be face-to-face? Well, you know, the pandemic kind of proved that it doesn't have to be. Then loops, so closed loop systems. How can we make it more circular in a loop rather than a straight line? You know, we use the example of moving agricultural fields around, you know, so potatoes, carrots, clover, etc. And then virtualizing is very much around, again, the digitalization of things. So Webinar Vet has digitalized education. That's a positive for SDG 4, the Sustainability Development Goal 4, because it gives quality education to people in developing countries who would never be able to travel to America or UK to be educated, but they can now be educated online. And most people who might have traveled don't now need to travel, so we're saving carbon and so on. And then the last one is exchange. So I suppose exchange of products so we can swap products around, but also producing when we need to so we don't produce excess. So the idea of 3D printing is printing for that particular animal rather than printing 10 of those, which may never get used. They're made of plastic. They end up going into landfill. So it's quite a nice system.
I often wonder about things like that and about, I'm not really a big car guy and I like cycling places. Yeah. And I live in a place where that's very doable. And if I have to travel up to London, I go via train. And although a significant amount of, I do travel on aircraft a lot because of trips to the United States, I offset those. But I often wonder about, you know, I was faced recently, you know, I'd run this car. It's an old second, probably third hand vehicle. And it's getting too expensive to run. And the question was, well, do I go electric? And I decided not to, principally the price of these things, the availability of charging, but also the expense in producing something new when there's perfectly good vehicles that are perhaps not electric, but there isn't that expense that goes with the production and the transportation of those, that sort of removing. And with like 3D printing, there's an expense in, like there has to be a volume point, doesn't there, for these technologies to make sense. Otherwise, you've got one thing per animal that you're 3D printing for. Mm. You've got like 1,000 3D printers. You would have had one in a factory before. So there's ebbs and flows of those things that sometimes I struggle to get my head around. But there is absolutely no question that we have to make so many changes in our lives. And it's the only thing I've agreed with Rishi Sunak on ever, I think, but for completely different reasons that I don't think he gives a hoot about. He said, like, you know, there is going to be change that's going to affect every element of our lives. And he's saying it trying to scare us into him being the custodian of our government, which couldn't be more ridiculous if I heard. But I think we have to embrace this and make the mini changes in our lives that if we all adopt those that have a massive difference. We just, initiatives run by governments are not what's going to change this.
I think it's really interesting, and this is where we need to discuss, and we need to just think deeply about things. And sometimes our consumerist society encourages not to think, but just to buy. So actually to spend some time to think, I think, is useful. It was a really great example that you used about the car, because as a business, we try not to use the car. We try to use public transport. So we try to use the train as much as we possibly can. It's not always, you know, possible, but I have a hybrid car. I've had a hybrid car for about the last 10, 15 years, but I don't use it a lot. And it sat in, you know, it does sit a lot, you know, at the front of my house. And I would very much think, oh, I should get an electric car, but actually I don't drive it a lot.
So yeah.
When you are producing electric cars, a lot of the carbon that is that car will emit over its lifetime is actually in the production phase.
Yeah, so front-loaded.
So it really makes no sense for me, who is not driving a lot of miles, to have an electric car. Now, if I was driving all around the country as a salesperson, then an electric car makes absolute sense, provided that there's enough charges around so that we can do it, so there's not this range anxiety, but also that the energy that I'm taking out from the charger is from renewable sources rather than just from gas and oil. So you can end up having an electric car feeling good about yourself, but if you're charging it at home, but you don't have a renewable energy, or you don't have solar panels on your roof, or when you're going out, it's not renewable, then that changes the whole perspective of that electric car.
Right.
And in fact, you know, I haven't got an electric car, and at some point I will probably get rid of this car and be much more. And for 2 years, in fact, I didn't have a car, because if I needed to, I rented a car. My wife has a car. She goes to school every day. It's obviously very practical. She needs it. It's a short distance. It would be difficult to go on the bus with all of the books that she's lugging around and things. So, you know, for 2 years, I rented a car when I needed it. So I think that's a big mindset change, isn't it? Because owning a car, it's like a rite of passage into adulthood, isn't it? You know, particularly, and I think probably it's more possible to do it in the UK. In America, the distances are so vast. The train systems are not that great. So, you know, I can understand culturally why, you know, me telling an American, no, you need to get rid of your car and use Ubers when you need them, you know, it's just not practical. But, you know, maybe then the electric car is the way to go, you know, in that country where there's obviously lots of sun and you can charge your cars, you know, electrically, which then saves you a lot of money. You know, I came down this morning and my electric meter hasn't moved because my house was powered by the battery overnight. And it's so nice to be able to metaphorically stick two fingers up to the big energy companies.
And how do you, because inevitably then you think about lots of littles makes a big, but lots of littles in Europe doesn't make that big a dent in world population and decisions. Yeah. And then there's the whole, well, look, people over there have had it your way for so long, and now the world's broken.
Yeah.
Actually, you expect us not to want to live a better quality of life. And so what about developing nations where there's massive populations that want a better quality of life, just like everybody wants that better quality of life? And they happen to exist in areas that are frequently much worse impacted through that sort of equatorial belt of the world, where an enormous amount of the world's population resides.
Yeah.
It can feel hopeless or drop in the ocean kind of thing. And that, I think a lot of people come up against that and think, well, what's the point if there's so many people aren't doing this, or if, and I'm not putting any statement of fact. I'm using what may or may not be true or may be complete tropes, but China's building lots of coal-fired power stations. What's the point for us? How would you answer people there? What hope would you give to people?
I suppose there's a few elements to it. You know, I went down to South Africa to talk about sustainability, and I started off by apologizing and saying, look, you know, a lot of the global warming that we're seeing is affecting the South much more than the North. I was at a conference last year in Edinburgh, and an Ethiopian vet said, you know, we've lost 1 million livestock through drought. You know, just think how that would appear if that was in the UK or in America, 1 million livestock dying. It's a massive, massive number. You know, it doesn't really get mentioned in the news. So very much the carbon that we have emitted in the UK, Europe, America, we're now beginning to see some of the effects on global warming with the floods, but these have been happening for a long time down in the South. So, you know, I absolutely agree. And I think that part of the COP agreement is that we spend $100 billion, it's either dollars or pounds, to give to poorer countries to allow them to begin to mitigate against some of these things, but also to bring technology in that will help them. And it's really interesting because what I did last year was spend a lot of time reading about sustainability, but also from an economist's point of view. I'm not an economist, but I read some books, Donut Economics, Values by Mark Carney, who was our governor of the Bank of England. And spending money now, and $100 billion sounds like a huge amount of money, it's much better to spend it now than when absolutely everything's broken, when it will be even more. You know, we saw that with COVID. We weren't prepared for COVID. The amount of money we spent, $39 billion on a test and trace system that didn't work. Had we had a system in place that we'd prepared that because we knew that pandemics were going to be more likely, we probably would have got it for a lot less than $39 billion. And the chances are, you know, it might have worked as well. So to mitigate and to prepare seems sensible. So I think we should be doing that. I think often, you know, places like South Africa are incredibly sunny compared with the UK, and actually looking at different ways of doing things. You know, we have a national grid. Some of these countries won't have as developed a national grid as we have, but actually having very local grids would be sensible, using things like wind and solar power. Obviously, we need to use some oil because there's transition, but we should be moving away from it as much as possible. There's a company, I think they're called Ayagaz or something, that are working in Africa, leasing out solar panels to people. They pay a bit back to them from the energy that they're saving, but it's done in a sustainable way. And I think these are the sort of areas that we should be working on to really decarbonize our energy system. So solar and wind are obviously, you know, the big ones that you would think about. In the UK and in Europe, I'm not a huge fan of nuclear, but maybe we need to do it as a sort of stopgap method. But we definitely need to start looking at reducing the amount of oil and gas that we're burning. And the reason I would say it's useful in Europe and America to do it is because when you do that locally, even though maybe China is still burning a lot of coal, the actual cleanness of the air, the benefits to human health and to animal health are, you know, amazing just because you've got clean air. I've been to Hong Kong. I haven't traveled in China a lot, but China, India, because they're using so much coal, some of the cities are barely inhabitable because of smog. You know, we lost lots of people in the 50s in London because of coal and smog and so on. And our fuel is now a lot cleaner. And in fact, you know, that's because there's a high percentage now, I think some days 50%, which is renewable.
Yeah.
But we're obviously putting less noxious chemicals. We're obviously using catalytic converters to take some of the particles out. But, you know, we're still putting some particles out into the atmosphere. So if we can do things locally, that green energy is much cleaner energy on the whole than using, you know, oil, gas or coal.
And the more of us use it, the more economic reason there is for others to invest in it as well. Exactly. So.
And I also think we should be an example. You know, I have an oil friend, and obviously Mr. Sunak's opened 30-odd wells, you know, for exploration. And obviously the argument is, well, you know, we don't want to be at the behest of Mr. Putin and so on. And actually, we've got to buy it from somewhere, so we may as well buy it from ourselves. But actually, my attitude would be that we should be putting that money into really quickening the green revolution. We started it in 2010. David Cameron talked about the green revolution, and then he saw how many people were buying solar panels, how many companies were setting up to put them on, how that was presumably affecting some of the bigger companies who are often, you know, donors to the Tory party. And of course, he stopped it. And we've lost 10 years, maybe longer, for that green revolution, because going solar is democratizing energy. You know, we obviously still need to have some help from, you know, the national grid and from the companies. But if we can do it successfully, there will be countries, you know, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, you can have much more electricity than you're getting at the moment if you've got a solar panel on your roof and a battery in your house.
Absolutely. Pulling us back into veterinary then, what would the three things for practice owners, let's go, what are three things that practice owners or leaders could do to improve their carbon footprints and their practices, and three things that veterinary individuals could do? What advice would you give?
I'm going to sort of make a point before we start this by saying, let's not obsess about carbon.
Yeah.
Because I think we can end up, let's put a load of trees in, but if put the wrong trees in the wrong places, then that affects biodiversity and so on. And also the whole area of recycling of plastics and so on. There's a stat at the moment that I think it was in 2018, 2019. If you look at the global economy, we could say that we were about 9% circular. So, you know, there was some stuff going on, but there wasn't a lot. I think it was either 22 or 23, we'd gone down to 7.2%. So we've actually become less circular. And obviously part of that is because we continue to use virgin materials to make plastics. We've got a growing population as well. So we need to look at all of those areas. So if I can broaden it slightly, I would say the first thing is use less energy. So low energy light bulbs, if you're buying computers, if you're buying, you know, x-ray machines, talk to the companies and say, right, how much energy does this machine use if it's turned on for 2 hours? And if they don't know that, then they need to start knowing it. You know, I've had an obsession for a long time. And when I buy an electrical machine, I try to buy the most energy efficient one, because obviously that's going to be using less energy. That's good for me because it will cost me less, but it's good for the planet as well.
Yeah.
Energy efficient appliances, low energy light bulbs now, LEDs, areas that you don't go into the practice very often, put a motion sensor in so it turns itself off. We all forget to turn lights off. It all adds up. If you're not using a renewable energy supplier, switch to a renewable energy supplier, because that's a really, really quick win. And the corollary of that is if we all switch to renewable energy suppliers and nobody actually puts solar panels on the roof, then we're going to run out of renewable energy. So we need to actually think about, could we be a micro generator? You know, companies listening to this, what are you doing with your roofs? All your roofs should be covered with solar panels. Can you feed that back into the grid? You know, I feed energy back into the grid as well as supplying my own house. So I'm doing something which is actually not emitting any carbon. In fact, I've got a kind of attempting to encourage 300 practices around the world to put solar panels on the roof. Because if we did this every year for the next 10 years, if 10% of our practices went solar on their roof, we probably would reduce our carbon by 50%, which is the target that we're being set to do by 2030. Obviously, each year we delay that, the percentage that we have to decrease by each year goes up. Had we started in 1990, it would have been a lot better. You know, planting trees 20 years ago was the best time to plant them. The next best time is today. So, you know, plant trees, if you can plant some trees, but put solar panels on your roof. Look at some of our policies, and I'm responsible for this. You know, I was one of the first to do a VIP plan in my practice. I was a dermatologist. I used a lot of ectoparasiticides. We now know that these products like imidacloprid and fipronil are being found in rivers. They're obviously powerful insecticides. Should we be using them preventatively, or should we be using them in a much more targeted way? And I think we started that conversation with Vet Sustain and BVA several years ago. Obviously, the pharmaceutical companies were a bit uncomfortable about it, but they're beginning to start to see that actually, if you produce a product that's destroying the environment, that's going to affect your reputation, and actually maybe you're better to have safeguards around those products. You know, we should still be using flea products, particularly, you know, if you're in Florida, you need to treat your dog or your cat for fleas. But maybe the way to treat it is knowing that the house is the major source of fleas. So use sodium borate. It's, you know, it's a fairly innocuous chemical to have in the house rather than an organophosphate. So when you're thinking about your treatments, I used to think very much in triangles. I used to think, you know, there's me, there's the client, and there's the dog or cat or horse or whatever the animal was. And I always used to say, particularly around euthanasia, you know, there's three people in this room and the dog is the most important person. As long as we make the right decision for the dog, then that's right. But with everything, you know, when we're deciding on a treatment for arthritis or whatever, if we don't involve the client in that, the likelihood is that they stop giving the treatment. So we have right. to, I've always thought of triangles in the way that the vet pet client relationship is, but I've actually now changed that into a square because, okay, what are the products that I'm using here? What am I going to be doing? Can this have an environmental effect? We're talking a lot in universities, oh, we don't want to bring sustainability in because it's going to be an extra five lectures. No, meld it into the curriculum. You know,
absolutely.
Have people thinking about it because it's a normal thing to think about rather than we are now going to have a five lecture series on sustainability. I don't think it's the way that we should be teaching it, you know, to the veterinary profession and certainly to the students. So there's some thoughts. If you can have some wildlife friendly garden at the front with, you know, pollinator plants, we know bees are in danger of being exterminated with all the issues that that would create. And I think it's really important that you as a vet realize that you're a leader in the community. If people see solar panels on your roof, if they see a bee-friendly garden at the front that isn't perfectly manicured and Victorian in its appearance, but looks maybe a bit rough and ready around the edges, but is much more colourful and has bees on it, that maybe will change some people's attitudes. We now have a situation, Dave, and I don't know if they have it in America, where people are replacing their lawns either with concrete, which doesn't help with drainage and is more likely to cause flooding, or even worse, with plastic grass that can actually burn dogs and cats' feet if it gets too hot and it starts to melt. So there are just some crazy things that would be really good to do. So if you are a veterinary practice with plastic grass at the front, please rip it up and put a wildlife meadow in there instead.
I love that. I love that. Gosh, Anthony, there's so much. Like, there's a lot.
Can I actually just make one more point, actually, because I think it's really important.
Please.
You know, this is a management podcast and leadership, and maybe we haven't talked a lot about that, you know, in definitive terms, but this is something that will benefit your practice because I have solar panels on my roof. It probably reduces my bill by half. So it makes financial sense now. You know, putting LED lighting in makes financial sense. But people are busy and people go, oh, there's so much stuff to do because of the daily busyness. But have somebody who looks around your practice and says, how can we save money? You know, stock control. If you've got 20% of your stock that gets wasted, you know, I can't remember the exact number, but the amount of food that we waste, we talk about not being able to feed the planet. Actually, all we need to do, we have a distribution problem. If we waste less food, if we accept that a food with an apple with a spot on is still okay to eat, it doesn't have to look perfect. So waste in general, you know, how can we get our stock control better? Because if we're making a pack of antibiotics of amoxicillin, clavulimox, there's a carbon cost to that. There's also a cost to what happens when it's going to be discarded. Is that just flushed down the toilet? And then we have sewage farms where there's bacteria in there that are antibiotic resistant to, you know, those bacteria. So all of these things, this thoughtfulness around waste, around, you know, saving money, but actually if you're saving money, you're probably helping to save the planet as well. So it makes economic sense.
And you're decoupling from a reliance on companies that year after year have shown time and time again to have scant regard for us as individuals because we're not shareholders. And whether it's Exxon Valdez or blowing ruptured pipelines or pipelines across sacred burial grounds or sugar in yeah. everything that we eat and processed foods. You know, there are lobbying groups that are pumping billions of dollars into politicians' campaign funds. And then therefore, it's simply about power and not about us and individuals. So to be able to, you know, that is the idea behind this democratization of power, or certainly the fragmentation of power away from big centralized, you know, companies that have an obligation on their formation documents to their shareholders, a legal obligation, but it's not to the future longevity of us as a species. And that's something individually we have to take very, very seriously. So I think, you know, it is absolutely, it makes financial sense now. If it didn't before, then certainly seeing a reliance on gas and oil, a dwindling resource that's killing our planet from state actors that are not particularly friendly yeah. toward us, just makes a ton of sense. And frankly, the world will be a better place with increased biodiversity.
I think also in America and Canada, I know sometimes there are outages of electricity, and I think this will yeah. happen more in the UK. In Holland, they recently refused Meta, a data center, because they said you will crash our grid. So I think this will happen. I've actually set up in my house, you know, if the electricity system fails globally on the grid in the UK, I can switch to a DC supply and my battery will supply me for a bit longer. I think this is also really important for resilience for veterinary business, because if you are having that and you haven't got a generator and, you know, the electricity goes off, it ruins all the vaccines in your fridge. Mm-hmm. You're in the middle of a bitch bay and all the lights go off and you can't carry on the operation. So I think there's a big point around how can you become a bit more self-sufficient as you're running a business. So it makes sense from a lot of areas, but it will require a bit of new thinking and a bit of time to actually sit down and reflect. And the other thing, the final little tip I will give is, and we're certainly doing it, and we're seeing companies that are not embracing this, is when a company comes in trying to sell you a product, say to them, okay, so what are you doing for the planet? And, you know, as much as if you've got a sustainability report, that's great.
Yeah.
How can you move quicker? And what are you doing that's actually tangible rather than fine words? Because again, finally, about my course, more and more people are talking about circularity. More and more people are talking about sustainability. You know, if you go on the internet, there will be no problem with you finding lots of articles on this. But yeah. I think we are still at the phase of talking too much and not doing enough. And as St. Francis of Assisi said, he said, preach all the time, use words occasionally, and actions speak much louder than words do. So, you know, we need to be doing things. And anybody listening, I would encourage you as an individual, do one thing. You know, the difficulty is that people feel that there's no point, because what will my little thing that I do make a difference? But if we all do it, it does add up. You know, if you drink out of plastic bottles, get yourself a bottle that's made out of tin that you can use all the time, you know, for drinking water.
Yeah.
There are little things that you can do. I really tried to deplasticize the house. We still have plastic in the house. It's impossible to get rid of it. But you can reduce it by 50% probably very easily with a bit of thought.
Absolutely.
So all just little, those little things as individuals make a difference. But then to the companies that we're working with, you know, the big companies, we know the names, but the small companies as well. Okay, what are you doing? How are you preparing us to be more circular and to be more sustainable?
And the one thing is for sure, we're all on notice that this is not going away. It's going yeah. to get to be a bigger and bigger issue, and action is going to be, you know, take it whilst you have the choice to take it, not because that choice is forced on you from an emergency situation. The lesson from COVID, by golly, you're right. So Anthony, 18th and 19th of June, your sustainability conference.
Yes,
give that a plug. Welcome. And I would ask you for that, a resource for people to start learning a bit more about the circular economy,
yes,
as it were. And obviously a shout out to your Webinar Vet platform yeah. for decarbonizing the learning experience as well.
Ellen MacArthur Foundation, Ellen Mac, M-A-C, Arthur Foundation is really good around the whole area of circularity. So if people want to delve deeper. We obviously do a lot on the Vet Chat podcast around sustainability. And, you know, you're doing that as well, which is great, Dave. So shout out to both podcasts. But also we've done webinars on the Webinar Vet site. Do go and have a look at that. Obviously, we don't just do stuff about sustainability. Our main area is clinical practice, but also, you know, practice management as well. And do feel free to go and have a shufti around the site as well. Once a year, we do a virtual congress, and one of the sessions is a sustainability summit. And we actually do Veterinary Green awards for the people who are making a difference in the profession as well. So there are different things going on. Do go and have a look at Vet Chat. Go and have a look at the Webinar Vet. And if you need any further advice or you just want to chat to me, LinkedIn is always a good spot. My name is Anthony Chadwick, or chat to me via anthony@thewebinarvet.com.
And you will find Anthony at pretty much all major conferences around the world, and you will not miss him because he is the giant. Like, if we stand next to each other, I basically come up to his navel because I'm a hobbit, and he is a giant.
Gandalf.
You are Gandalf. Literally cuts a swathe through the crowd with his luscious white locks and his fantastic Liverpudlian accent. So please check out Anthony. So you can go to thewebinarvet.com, where you can find so much content and slash your education bill at the very least, but just an absolute miracle.
A decent percentage of it is race accredited as well.
Yeah.
But we see it now as a video encyclopedia. You know, there is so much stuff on. So it'd be lovely to hear people's thoughts and comments about it.
Fantastic. You can listen to Vet Chat by the Webinar Vet. You can search that podcast out on all podcast platforms, and you can find Anthony on LinkedIn. Anthony, thank you so much. This time has absolutely flown past. We didn't get anywhere near half the questions we're going to ask, but actually the stuff we did get near felt so good and profound and fascinating to talk about, and probably much more important than business in general. So thank you so much for your time and your educating me. I learned a lot during the podcast, and really enjoyed spending the time with you.
Thank you, David, and thanks for all that you do for the profession as well.
Pleasure. All right, guys, that's it for this episode. We will see you next time on Blunt Dissection Podcast.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
So that is a wrap for another episode of Blunt Dissection. Thank you so much for listening. Before you jump off and get on with your life, would you do me a little favor? Or maybe three. Favor one, would you just do a quick shout out on social media to let people know you enjoyed the show? Favor two, drop a little review onto iTunes. And favor three, if you think somebody needs to benefit and hear this show today, please share it with them. The show has helped countless people overcome countless problems over the years we've been doing it. And it's recommendations and shares that allow that magic to happen. So from all of us here at Blunt Dissection Podcast, to all of you out there, until next time, be safe, be well, and be happy.